Continuing the Joy of Dharma teachings with Cecily Quiet. This is tape 8, side 1, Mount Lauren Community Center, September 12th, 2005.
Very kind of you to wait for me. Thank you. Hopefully, I'll say something that's interesting that will make it worth your while. I'll do my best. Meanwhile, Namo, Asana, Arahant, Sama, Sambuddhi. Namo, my name, Tassa, the state, Bhagavato of blessedness, Arahato, victory over illusion, Sama, with fully, Sambuddha, Sama is the whole, holy Sambuddhasa with that state of discovery. Namo Tassa. Sama Sambuddhasa. It's just the kind of thing you always say if you want to remind yourself what you really want to talk about, rather than what my brother and I were just doing. The light's too bright here. It always will be true. So, we were talking on the weekend about things like refuge and what refuge is in Buddhism. And I wondered if you wanted me to talk a little bit about that, or if you had any particular questions for me, or anything that you were interested in following up on. Or you want to just see what I'm going to say before you. One of the things I was saying about refuge in the Buddhist tradition on the weekend is that the actual idea of refuge, although you use the image, the symbolic image of a no-name brand guru figure, who is essentially kind of like, in our society, a BMW for a car, or Kraft dinner for a meal. You know, those are things that all of us can relate to. That give us a vague idea. I think all of us can relate to that. I was kind of thinking, or am I just too tied to the South? You've all heard of BMWs if you haven't driven one. Yeah, good. Okay. And I myself have never driven a BMW, have ridden in a few, never mind, and sometimes not belonging to the people who were driving them. However, I do know what a BMW represents, and there is this, for many people, just having that name attached gives a little extra je ne sais quoi to the whole story. Would you think that's true in your experience? So then what happens is that when you're looking at a figure that you image in front of you in the Buddhist meditations, you're supposed to be looking at your aspiration toward that figure. The figure is meant to awaken your aspiration, which is where a lot of us get into trouble, I think, when we're going to take refuge, because a lot of the time we look for a root guru, and I don't know if any of you have ever noticed, if you actually have a teacher, sometimes they don't do what's right. like they use your left finger for picking the feet as to really like, you know what I'm saying? There's these little things they, you have to kind of squint sometimes and not look too closely or your own view will be disturbed. And you notice that this can happen, whether it's a spiritual teacher or any kind of teacher. So those things can really throw us off. Would you think that might, you might know somebody that that might have happened to once, say, some other century or something, you know, seen that happen on occasion or read about it. That person isn't my root guru anymore because dot, 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 fill in the blanks. But the real teaching about root guru is very simple. Any being who is the root of some information that you have learned and tested for yourself and found to be true is a root guru. So, as I was saying on the weekend, if you learned how to do subtraction in grade one, your root guru for subtraction is your grade one teacher. Not even, even if you can't remember their name. That quality of trying to see it, and then putting the apples or whatever it was on the board, and then taking away two or whatever, and then suddenly going, aha! That moment between trying to figure out what they're doing and suddenly getting a new understanding. That moment, right between the two. That's the energy of root guru. It means that you're clear, you're present, you're not negating any of your past experience, neither is it going to color the possibilities of the future. Isn't that right? No? Maybe? Maybe, okay. So at that point, you have all of the interest and confidence of the present moment, whether it's, you know, jumping in and out of barnyard paths of shit. Larry was telling me a wonderful story about a robin that he met once in the Yukon earlier, over dinner, I might add. Oh, it was done. Oh, thank you. I'm glad some of the things of our parents have survived. that there is this quality of like not referencing to your past, so you're not referencing to who you should be in relation to, and not looking forward to the future because you got nothing, but the mind is totally open. Alert, interested, present, and totally open. That's a very magical kind of state, isn't it? And what happens is that we tend to get the answer and then go around and show everybody the answer. But the real answer is that state. So I get this magazine called Buddha Dharma. Do you know that magazine? I said I really liked an issue a friend had, and she keeps sending me subscriptions, which is really amazing of her that she's so kind. It takes me probably about 6 months to read one, and they come out four times a year. So I have a couple I haven't opened yet, but I finished reading the one that came out in the summer. When did I finish it? I think about a week ago. And this one, fall one, has been in my home for a month, and I opened it today. After Buddha Dharma, it's called. Very beautiful, nice. And in it, so I've been talking to people for quite a while about firsts, and about how important that state is between you don't know something and then when you know it. But just that state itself, and that is the state of Buddha. That is the state of Buddha. So really, it is a no-name brand, and if there is someone who particularly helps you, for whatever reason, open to that state, that even helps it more. If you don't have somebody, that doesn't mean you don't have your Guru. It means you have to hold that no-name brand up there, and then like they're a piggy bank or something. Just put start thinking about a bunch of firsts. And just imagine, you know, stuffing that figure full of them so it starts to gleam back at you with them. You know, because I have that kind of mind, maybe that image works, doesn't work for you, but are you getting some idea of how one could play with that? So I'm reading this. Beautiful teacher is talking about his guru, who was his uncle. I remember well one particular instruction that, this was this afternoon, I was reading this, that Samten Nyingtso gave me at an early age. It had to do with the teaching on the profound topic of essence, nature, and capacity. He said, the word capacity refers to the unconfined basis for experience. Isn't that beautiful? As in the moment just before something takes place. I hadn't read it before, honestly. It's right here. Some real Tibetan guru said this, guys. So this goes to show you that even you and I have wisdom in us. Doesn't it? Once the arising has occurred, it usually has already turned into a thought. Capacity means the basis for that to happen. An unimpeded quality of awareness. This unimpeded quality is extremely subtle and significant. Once you acknowledge this unimpededness, nothing more needs to be done. In this unimpededness, it is impossible to find any subject or object. You're just wide open, just between jumping and landing. The analogy for this is a bright mirror, a readiness for experience to unfold without any preconceptions whatsoever. So please understand very well the third of these three, essence, nature, and capacity. The capacity, the nature of capacity itself is the nature of first, that moment. Just when you're open to the first, just at that moment we see the actual nature of our consciousness. Just at that moment. But then we get addicted to answers, don't we? Because where there's an object, there's a subject. And you notice? I don't know. Where there's an object, where there's a subject. Where there's a subject, it's very hard not to have clinging. Very hard to let go. To just be present with the subject object coming into being and passing away, and always aware of that first energy. Always present, always love, always profound, regardless of the actual subject object experience, untouched by that. So I thought I might talk a little bit about that. Was that interesting? Or giddy. Does it bring up any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Oh, I thought you had that look of a question on your face. The first time you were reaching for Danny? And then you touch your skin. That moment between the two. See, there is a very profound state of full, generous, luminous consciousness in that moment. But the next moment we have an experience, and then the name kind of takes our attention, and we forget to look at the spaciousness, the clarity in which the name is dancing. So when we're looking for something, we're looking for the object, we're not looking for the experience. It's not an object, it's an experience. It is the experience of our mind. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Why do you have to work with it? Isn't it always there? You have to water it or anything? You're a very unusual person if you do.
It takes a little managing.
Why does it take managing? Because you're perfecting my favorite. Remember my favorite I was talking about? Which was what? My favorite design? You don't remember me talking about that? Huh? I really wanted to not want. And it's funny though that you didn't remember that. So that's desire. So what is it that you want to do with, why are you turning desire against desire? Why don't you enjoy desire? I'm not saying enjoy objects that desire focus on. Why don't you just enjoy the desire itself?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering how what it's arising and it attaches to something. How just to stay with the.
Well, first of all, don't go to your mind.
Pardon me?
First of all, don't go to your mind. Go to your body. It's arising in your body, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then your mind starts playing with objects, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. To divide it up into things you can control. As if that's going to make it go away or that's going to make it go away.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying hmm because you'd like it to be true or because you know it's true?
I think I'm following.
Didn't answer either one of my questions. Damn, she's good. She is so good. I think we should change seats. You sure?
What am I missing here?
Oh, nothing. That's what I'm saying. I give you two possibilities and you go for a third. You're not missing a thing. You're better than me. What did you say?
I don't know.
I think I'm following you. I'm saying, what is it that you're watching? Desire in the mind or desire in the body? Let's go back to there. What is it you start following? The desire comes up. When are you first aware of it?
When I feel it in my body.
Yeah, and then what happens? Then it goes to your mind.
Yeah, then it goes to my mind.
So then don't let it go to your mind. Just really wiggle your toes one at a time. Pay attention to your back, where you are. I was at my dentist once. I had two teeth left. He said, I'm sorry, we're going to have to pull your teeth. Okay. The last part of us the last part of one set of myself to go. I've never had an operation. Starts to pull in its absence. I'm sort of, you know, like this on the chair instead of that. You know, my body is kind of like held up by my knees and my shoulders. He stops. He's so kind. He says, look, I can stop. We can put more anesthetic in. I'm not sure it's going to take because it's still, you know, it's not as abscessed as it was, but it's still pretty bad. I am just about done. It's almost up. I go, how far is it? In other words, how far is it? It should just be a very short time, honest. Okay, go ahead. Okay, go ahead. He starts to bend down again. His nurse comes over and says, it's for this ear. You're going to be close. I go, what? What? I've been telling people to wiggle their toes for like 20 years. Hey, you heard? I'm so fascinated by her. I can hardly wait for him to get it out. I'm so good, so relaxed. Finally, he gets the tooth out. As soon as I finished spitting, I got my hand on her. Why did you tell me to wiggle my toes? Oh, she said, it was something they recently discovered, she said, that when you wiggle your toes, it changes the blood flow from your brain, and your brain doesn't get caught up in thought as much, and it starts to create more the flight mechanism, more brings the energy more into your body. Now, I discovered this a very long time ago. And at first I thought it was just a fluke, but when I started getting interested in really practicing it, I found that it actually worked. And then I discovered if I put my mind on my toes and tried to move them slowly and pretended I was interested, it worked. And within, if you actually really pretend you're interested, which you almost did, really, and you could feel the shift down. You immediately, as soon as you felt your stomach tight, you went, oh my, instead of just relaxing, never mind. I have told to so many people, you know, snot will not kill you. You know, I've told so many people that. I've told people so many times. One person in this room has heard that from me. But to actually pay attention to it and see what happens when you just wiggle one toe at a time, when you feel fear, when you feel, you know, anger, when you feel grief, leave that alone. Put your focus on a neutral spot. It's very hard for your toe to feel grief. I mean, maybe there's somebody who could do it. I have not met anybody. Your toe can send pain signals, and you can say, my toe! But that's not where the grief is coming. This is neutral. And if you try to move your toe a different way, you want to know where I learned this? Do you want to know where I learned this? Right? I actually learned this when I was in the hospital for that 3 months. You know, when I was in the sling. At first the physio came and started letting me learn how to move my legs so they wouldn't atrophy too much. And then I noticed that when I wiggled my toes really slowly, different ways, it totally changed my attitude to the pain. So when people say, yeah, that it doesn't work all the time, I look up and say, oh, okay. That means to say they don't want to take their hand off of their addiction, even if the excess is there all the time. It's very straightforward. That's their business, not mine. Is that true? If they want to know a place that works, you've got these wonderful things on both feet. Even if you're a paraplegic, you can do it. I used to work at a paraplegic hospital. I know it works. But if you've got a paraplegic heart, It doesn't want to move. Yeah. You have the right to find out where it takes you, don't you? We all have the power of our own lives, don't we? It isn't what we do, what other people do to us, or how we don't do things right, you know, or how we can never do anything right. It's how can we learn what we haven't done and be happy about it. Because basically self-pity doesn't get any more brownie points or merit in the merit bank. You know, how in Buddhism merit is so important. Well, you don't, unfortunately, I tried that one too for quite a while, collecting, you know, merit points by self-pity. I was using that thing for experience, I think. It's not done in public, I know. I didn't do that. So no matter how much self-pity or self-remorse or all that stuff you practice, it's just a waste of time, isn't it? And who's going to hang out with you? I'm asking you, like really, who will hang out with you for doing this? No kidding! So what do you have to do for them to stay around for you? Can listen to their stories. But they might distract you from yours. So you gotta figure out when you need to go to the bathroom or when you know, like you gotta keep, it's a lot of timing. I mean, it's major upkeep. And there's so many other things you could do. You could, you know, look at the leaves. I mean, that's worth at least 10 minutes. You know? So it isn't a point about whether or not there is something to do with desire or anger or ignorance and greed, hatred, delusion, pride, and jealousy, the big five of Buddhism. It's not a matter of working with them. It's a matter of not working. It's not a matter of holding on to the right answer. It's a matter of looking at how you got to the right answer and holding on to the mind that is so vast it couldn't mean anything. Because one right answer is only a right answer from my point of view, and in the middle of the summer in black fly season, I'm in a minority. Okay? Are there more black flies than people in the Nepal? Is the Pope Catholic? Do bears shit in the woods? What's the answer to these three questions? Is that true? So why? Why do you do anything with desire? Why don't do anything with desire? Instead, ground yourself in your body, get interested in a present neutral point. And switch from one foot to the other. Straightforward. The emotion comes, the emotion goes. Why does it go? Because you're not feeding it, and all compounded things are impermanent. Get out of the way. The train will go through. If you insist on standing there saying, oh no, a train, I've got to fight it, you're going to go a long way down the track. Very long way down the track. And then a train will come in the other direction, and you go along. And you just go back and forth. You say, what am I doing wrong? As you're standing in the middle of the track, and another train will come in a very long way down the track.
You got me.
You got that in it? Oh, God. I'm delighted. For most of us, most of the time, because our desires don't bring us the happiness we want, we think they're bad, and so we're supposed to cut them off. for most of us, most of the time, those desires that we don't think are bad and we don't cut them off, we are, don't want to be aware of how they might be getting in the way of somebody else getting what they want, like the cow that I'm eating. Right? Or the thousands of bugs I killed because I like rice. Right? Or how many microbes I just disturbed because I breathed in. Now the Buddha could have become a Jain. You know what the Jains are?
No.
The Jains are a religion that were precursors of Buddhism by a few hundred years, 200, 300, maybe 400 years, something like that. And they are, have very similar kind of teachings to Buddhism and Hinduism. And they're slightly offshoot because they believe that you must try to purify all your actions. They're very careful vegetarians, and they try when they reap their crops, they grow small crops, and they try to remove all the bugs before they... Getting the idea here? When they walk down the street, they sweep in front of them so they don't step on something accidentally. Some of them go so far as to wear a mask so they don't breathe anything in. They didn't have the same microscope, so they couldn't see what died every time they swallowed. All the little bugs in there. Or when you rub your eye, how many things they just knocked off. Whole generation. In Buddhism, you have this statement. It goes, all beings live by nutriment, all beings desire flesh. There's the numbers versus what is the one, all beings desire nutriment. What is the one, all beings desire flesh. Nutriment is first. And one of the first rules in Buddhism when you begin to practice is I undertake to train myself to refrain from killing and harming. If you really take that seriously and really try to explore it, you go through incredible pain and torment, because eventually you will have to realize that it's not possible for me to live without some you dying. So then that brings it down to a whole other thing. I undertake to train myself to refrain from killing and harming. Whenever I can, I will do that. When I take nutriment, I will be grateful for all beings and wish somehow that they could have nutriment. One of the great saints in Tibet said something once about, I think it was actually a Theravada monk, I can't remember, who said something about if there were a God who could make it possible for me to eat without killing or harming anyone, I would totally believe in the omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence of that God. The only way that can be true is if interdependence is true. If I am not separate from you. So that brings me back from my search to refrain from killing and harming, to trying to see who I am. And if I really pay attention, rather than fucking around with good and bad, and start looking directly about, not that. Who is the I? Who is I? Is there an I? And I actually start keeping track of how many eyes go through in a day. But then pretty soon you get as many in an hour as you used to get in a day. And then pretty soon you get as many in 5 minutes as you used to get in an hour. And then you start thinking, well, where did this eye come from? And how can it be separate from the elements that are around me? Where did this body? And then you start getting into the container and the contained. And then you start trying to explore the relationship in between. And then you start exploring the relationships outside. And then you understand what is meant by interdependence. And if you don't understand interdependence, you cannot possibly understand your role in the world. That's a Buddhist point of view. Or at least Buddhist point of view. Anything anyone wants to add to it?
So the Buddha could have become a deity. That's what I started to
Buddhism appreciated and admired the search of Jains, and after looking into it, found it impractical. You know what the Buddha decided one time, that he should take refuge. Did you know that? So you know what he decided to take refuge in? Truth. He was sitting around one day meditating, and he thought, well, it's not good that I don't take refuge in something, because it's useful for my followers to know that when they get stuck on thinking of me as a person, to know that there is something that even I go with. So what should I do to take refuge in? Maybe should I take refuge in another teacher? It's not really another teacher I really feel honest about taking refuge in. Okay, can't do that. Should I take refuge in everyone else? And it's closer, but it's still not quite right. Something wrong there. Oh, I guess I have to take refuge in that. Dharma is, he who sees Dharma sees me, he who sees me sees Dharma. Because we really do become our refuge, don't we? At some point, don't you think? At some point, your refuge is not separate from who you are. In the Sakya tradition of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, they say the path and the result are not separate. I think that's very nice. Did I not answer you okay?
Thank you.
I need a sieve between my teeth.
You don't refrain from being master for your
a killer.
You're cold blooded.
Well, I'm not exactly cold blooded, but definitely a killer.
But it's recognizing the interconnectedness is not necessarily what makes you a killer.
It makes you realize what is true and what is not true. So a question like, is it possible to live without killing or harming in any way at all, becomes a profound spiritual search. And each one of the five are like that. Undertake to train myself to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. Well, there's a little hook in there, isn't there? Freely given. What is ever freely given? That person gave that to me freely because they got joy out of it. Is that freely? Well, what is giving? Is giving, you know, every one of those five rules or precepts, which are very similar to the Ten Commandments. Every one of those five have a quality that causes you to look more and more cleanly and with more and more compassion on all living beings, you, all beings, and get a lot more dogmatic in what really is possible in one's life. There are people who realize that it's impossible to live without killing or stealing, but they know they themselves are too prone to pleasure and they need to like cut out of some things for their benefit, to better be aware of all things. So the rule is very straight. What I undertake to train myself to refrain from. That's the actual translation. And so when you actually start training yourself to refrain from, that basically means you're not going to be a glutton. It means you're going to have respect for all life. And as you eat, you wish all beings to eat. And maybe you actually incorporate a few other things, like praying to the spirits of the animals, that the one who is willing to, you know, give their life. Everyone has their own way of working with that. And the precepts are basically given as a way to start you paying attention to what it is to be, about what it is, what it means to be alive. And eventually what it means to be alive becomes interdependence. Does that make it clear? Thanks for the question. Any other questions, answers, comments? No? You might get a hafiz, you know.
No good.
Oh! Do you know hafiz?
No.
I heard God laugh. Renderings of Hafiz, and it's translated by Daniel Ladinsky, and he says things like, we've all come to the right place, we all sit in God's classroom. Now the only thing left for us to do, my dear, is to stop throwing spitballs for a while. How about this one? The small man builds cages for everyone he knows. While the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful rowdy prisoners. The beautiful, loud prisoners. You don't have to act crazy anymore. We all know you were good at that. Now retire, my dear, from all that hard work. Bringing pain to your sweet eyes and your heart. Look into a clear mountain mirror. See the beautiful ancient warrior and the divine elements you always carry inside, that infused the universe with sacred life so long ago, and join you eternally with all existence and love. Nice poem on interdependence. You have been invited to meet the friend. No one can resist a divine invitation. That narrows down all our choices to just two. We can come to God's dressed for dancing or be carried in on a stretcher to God's ward. What does purity do? It cuts the plow reins. It frees you from working and dining in the mud. It frees you from living behind a big ox that is always breaking wind. What can purity do, my dear? It can lift your heart on a rising, bucking sun that makes the soul hunger to reach the roof of creation. It offers the whole world what the whole world wants: real knowledge and power. It offers what the wise crave: the priceless treasure of truth. Pure divine love is no meek priest or tight banker. It will smash all your windows and only then throw in your holy gifts. Not a lot. It will allow you to befriend life and light and sanity and not even mind waking to another day. It reveals the excitement of the present and the beauty of precision. It confers vitality and a sublime power. Until finally all the heart can do is burst open with great love and laughter. Oh, purity, oh, dear truth and friend within me, why didn't you tell me this sooner? You could do all this. Cut the veins of the reins of illusion so we can all just go wild loving God and everybody all day. He's nice, isn't he? I read you pulling out the chair, didn't I? I should read it again, yeah? Pulling out the chair beneath your mind and watching you fall upon God. What else is there for Hafiz to do that's any fun in this world? It's called true love. Must be in the other book, which I didn't bring. So, is that enough poetry? Poetry is just for a little, so you actually hear something really important. I'm the chief act between the poets. What was in here? Okay. So, you don't have any particular thing you want me to talk about, because I'll just start going on. Sorry? It can be very, very useful in daily life. You actually can do it so that nobody notices. It's very rarely are people looking at your feet. And you can do it when somebody's talking to you and you feel yourself starting to get fading out or getting defensive or, you know, wishing they'd go away, or really excited about talking to them and not like in your body. Do you understand? Then you just, while you're there, another way you can do it, my beloved teacher Namjai Rinpoche suggested that you see the Buddha behind you, just over your shoulder. It does a similar kind of thing. It balances your energy so that you're not all up here, you're aware of the space your body is in. So when you're wiggling your toes or you're imagining somebody behind you, what you're essentially doing is that you're working with space. And when you get too caught up in something, you're losing space within yourself or in relation to the world. You're losing the space, so you lose perspective. And the more you lose perspective, the more you get determined that you're just going to get that point finished one way or the other. So the developing a habitual way to react is very